Was there an Eve, or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
oh, don't yeah. You know, started to burn too many things we found. This is the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show here with Harvey Sogo Wasserman. Another hour of tons of stuff going on. I'm going to be joined, hopefully, by Bob Fitricus. Bob, you with us? And Mark Ash. Okay, we are going to roll along here. We're going to talk about Diablo Canyon, the nuclear power plant. Then we're going to get into Venezuela and Michael Cohen and God knows what else. But we're going to rock and roll here. First with Diablo Canyon, the nuclear power plant in California. We have had word from Gavin Newsom that he is supposed to do something about Diablo Canyon, and so far we haven't seen anything. And today, monumentally, Pacific Gas and Electric, which owns Diablo Canyon, has admitted or has let the public know that it is culpable for the campfires. Now, the campfires occurred last year. They killed about 80 people. They wiped. Just mind-boggling to hear one say. Who's on with us?
Mark.
Hey, Mark. Hello. How are you, buddy?
Hello.
How you doing, Mark? Now, you're in Northern California. We're going to talk today about Michael Cohen, about Venezuela, about Korea. Trump just bit the big one again. But I want to start talking. You're a Northern Californian. I'm a Southern Californian. And we did have a major monumental, we talked about Michael Cohen in particular. I hope you watched him, by the way, or at least some of it yesterday. It was astounding. I do want to talk about these fires and the Diablo Canyon nuclear plant. I arranged with you, you are the publisher of the truly great website, Reader Supported News. It's amazing you're able to keep it going. It's a fantastic place, and more power to you. And thank you for publishing my stuff. I called you last weekend to arrange an exclusive that we could publish immediately because I had gotten back channel word from Gavin Newsom, the new governor of California, that he was going to do something dramatic about Diablo Canyon on Monday. And I wanted us to be able to get the piece right up. And of course, he completely punked out. It's now Thursday and we still haven't heard a word from Governor Gavin Newsom on Diablo Canyon. So, Gavin, if you're listening, we need you to do something about Diablo Canyon, this nuclear power plant in Central California. God forbid that plant should, right now Unit 1 is shut, and God forbid it should go back online and then blow up, which we have seen four reactors blow up at Fukushima and one at Chernobyl and one almost blow up at Three Mile Island. And by the way, we're very close to next month is the 40th anniversary of the disaster at Three Mile Island. But the reality is that in the New York Times today, it is front page. Pacific Gas and Electric. Oh, Bob, how you doing, buddy? Bob, you with us?
Yeah, doing well. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you. And we got Mark Ash, Bob Fitricus, publisher of the fantastic Free Press in Columbus, FreePress.org and Columbus Free Press, and Mark Ash, publisher of Reader Supported News. We have two media barons of the left here on the same show. Bob, I'm talking about the Diablo Canyon nuclear plant. I wanted to open this with this because I know once we get into Trump and the new Watergate here, it will be no stopping it. So today, just today, Pacific Gas and Electric has admitted culpability saying it probably started the campfire in Northern California, killing 80 people, burning more than 10,000 structures. I mean, this is an apocalyptic event. Now, Mark, you live up in that neighborhood. What can you tell us about the campfire and what happened in Northern California?
Well, I can tell you that we're not going to get anywhere near the campfire today because we've got a massive flooding in my area, and everybody is completely inundated, and it's just basically we have people whose homes are being destroyed by flood. But when it warms up, the fires will return. So it's getting pretty dicey.
I assume that the flooding is caused in part by the deforestation caused by the fires. Is that a safe assumption?
Not really. It's just heavy sustained rains. You know, we this area is prone to these things. It hasn't happened in 25 years. It's happening now, but there is no fire danger right now, I can assure you. I would say that the fire situation, it's being made worse in large part because a lot of structures are being built in what would otherwise be fire-prone areas. And as those the numbers of structures continue to push out into what would otherwise have been wild areas, you see more and more instances of catastrophic fires. The weather patterns are changing as well. And there are a number of factors that affect it. The weather patterns are certainly a contributing factor. If you're going to build out there, then you better beware.
Yes. Well, how far away are you from where the campfire was?
Well, the campfire was probably about 75 miles from here. But we had the big fires in Santa Rosa the year before.
Oh,
God,
yeah.
And those came within 12 miles of my house.
Oh, my God. And that burned. I have been in Santa Rosa. Santa Rosa was a beautiful, beautiful town. And the idea that fires could go through populated area, sophisticated, this is not the third world Santa Rosa. I mean, it is an upscale, very well-maintained city, and, I haven't been there since the fires. I can't even imagine what it was like. And
the fires started to the east, and they blew to the west, which is, as if you're Southern California, you know the drill. And what they did is they came through what was basically say scrublands, rolling hills, oaks, dry grasses, that kind of stuff. And when the fire gets going in those areas, it can move very, very quickly. Typically, it doesn't kill the trees. Typically, it just burns the grass, singes the trees, and keeps on moving. But when it runs into residential dwellings, typically built of residential building materials, those structures are going to go.
So what has happened now is the Pacific Gas and Electric has admitted that its failure to maintain its power lines by making sure the power lines can actually stand up to wind and can shut off in emergencies and clearing the underbrush from the power lines, which PG&E has not done.
Well, that's a hot button issue as well.
They have admitted to $10 billion of liability now.
Sure. At the end of the day, has the state of California established whether or not it's going to pass legislation to immunize PG&E from liability? They usually do.
God.
Just FYI.
Yeah. Well, let's see what happens. Yeah. So our concern now is that these are the same clowns that are running the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant. We were told the governor was going to act. We've pounced on this because the Unit 1 has been shut for refueling and the company's in bankruptcy, and we thought we could get a rise out of the governor. We have more than a dozen cities, towns, counties, the Democratic Party of Los Angeles County, where 10 million people live, more than 1,000 signatures on a move-on petition, signatures from Jane Fonda, Martin Sheen, Mimi Kennedy, Jody Evans, Ed Asner, Eric Roberts. I mean, everything you could possibly do to lobby the governor of the state of California to do something about this nuclear plant owned by a company that just killed 80 people and burned down 12,000 structures in Silkmore. We haven't heard a peep. So we are now turning our focus to the judges. But I got to tell you, if Diablo Unit 1 goes back online without being inspected for embrittlement, cracking, deferred maintenance, earthquake faults, waste management, incompetence, you name it, then, you know, we're in deep trouble. And, Mark, I hope to have a story to you and to Bob soon about Diablo Canyon. So let's turn now. I originally wanted you both you guys on to talk about something that's disappeared a bit from the headlines, which is Venezuela. We saw it yesterday. I got to say, I was watching Fox News because I was channel flipping, and this horrible ogre, this Laura Ingraham, was complaining that all the coverage was about Michael Cohen, and here was our great leader in Korea forging a Nobel Prize-winning deal, and the deal has just fallen through. I love it. Bob, you and Mark are real experts on Venezuela. Both of you have written extensively. Bob, we'll start with you. What is the latest from Venezuela, and what can we expect?
Who knows with, these stages of the soft coup. And I mean, I'm still stunned by the reemergence of Elliot Abrams, right? You know, so you go out and get a criminal from the Iran-Contra era, and somehow you're trying to portray this as, in line with human rights. But I really couldn't help the irony. You're hanging out with, the North Korean Marxist-Leninist dictator in, Marxist-Leninist communist Vietnam, while complaining about the evil of socialism in the crisis in Venezuela, which you created, by grabbing, the money from Citgo and closing down the refineries they need. So you create this crisis and bring in the term socialism while you're meeting with, in a communist country with a communist dictator.
And then failing to come to a deal.
I mean, and you can't get the deal done.
I mean, Fox, these guys on there were sitting around, these morons on Fox yesterday were complaining because Trump's about to win the Nobel Prize for getting peace in Vietnam. And here everybody's listening to this lying Jew, Michael Cohen. And then all of a sudden the deal falls through in North Korea. These guys are unbelievable. Mark Ash, you wrote a great piece on Venezuela. Tell us what you think.
This is a continuation of everything we've seen since Hugo Chavez took over and signaled his support for, Fidel Castro. The U.S. is absolutely staunchly opposed to any kind of socialist or communist South American government. There is oil there. They have all the components you need for an explosive situation. They've been trying to undermine both the Chavez government and the Maduro government perpetually since Chavez won. In fact, at one point, they actually allege that Chavez was spirited offshore to a U.S. naval vessel. And there are many Venezuelans who don't believe that Chavez just contracted cancer. They believe he was poisoned by the U.S. I don't think there's any hard evidence to back that up, but there are a lot of people there that believe it.
But we've heard
US
the same about Bob Marley.
The U.S. has an overbearing attitude towards South America and Central America. And a lot of people have died as a result of this. And when you hear, when you listen to what the Venezuelan leaders and the people say, their attitude is very, very resistant to U.S. interference. we'll take a look at Elliot Abrams. We take a look at this kind of charade that's unfolding at the Colombian border with aid being stacked up at the border and trying to get to the Venezuelan people. And this is probably Elliot Abrams' first act. This is a charade.
God.
This is a game. This isn't about aid. If they wanted aid for the Venezuelan people, they could pay for the oil they haven't even paid for. That would buy a lot of medicine and a lot of aspirin.
Well, who is taking the Venezuelan oil and not paid for it?
They effectively, one of the steps that was taken by the Trump administration was to withhold payment for Venezuelan oil that has been arriving in the United States during his tenure. So effectively their position as they articulated was they can ship as much oil as they want, but they're not going to get any cash for it.
Who's buying it? American oil companies?
Well, it's complicated. Unfortunately for the Venezuelans, they can ship their oil to a number of countries, particularly China and Russia, who will purchase their oil. However, since they have provided aid to Venezuela, they take the position that the oil is part of the payment on their debt. So effectively, the only country from which they were getting cash was the United States. Now they're not getting that cash any longer. So that's another impediment and another problem that they have to face.
Wow.
But this is the exact same thing that unfolded in Cuba. This is virtually a carbon copy of the U.S. game plan in Cuba from 1957 on. After the July 5th revolution, the United States waged economic war on Cuba and really damaged their economy The Cuba existed under Castro's rule primarily as an impoverished nation. They had some very good things they did in terms of health care and benefits, but it was a poor country. They could not export there was no ability to export their goods, establish a fair economy, fair trade with the U.S. That wasn't going to happen. The U.S. doesn't do fair trade. We do domination of trade.
Bob Patrikis, you want to add to what Mark is saying here?
Oh, no, I agree with the analysis. I mean, what often isn't being talked about, you know, because I have taught today and, my students, particularly those on the right will, have certain lines they pick up from Fox News, et cetera. But one of the things like, well, there's 50 countries now. Well, there's 200 countries in the world. The fact that you got a quarter of them because you're strong arming people and there's some right wing reactionary regimes in South America now that'll go along with it. Doesn't mean the vast majority of the people and nations of the earth aren't going along with it. So you've got that in. And this question that these are, acts of war. If war breaks out there, is that, it's war crimes. Is that this is the use of the U.S. military if we militarily intervene, if we move back, if we're actually moving troops in that area. Using the military to regime change. That's a violation of international law. It's waging aggressive war. And the fact, I think Mark's absolutely right. They threw in Nicaragua and Cuba again. It's like, why? I mean, the only two countries, one in Central America, and one there in the Caribbean that stood up to the United States. None of it, makes any sense outside the fact that, Venezuela's thought to have the largest, oil reserves in the world. And even though it's a lot of it is, the heavy crude, it's not the light sweet. And it's really, been dependent to some extent on refining it in the U.S. is, well, we need to talk about this in terms of, you know, an illegal activity that if we get involved on any military level, it is in fact a war crime, because this is just the neoconservative dream of people like Elliot Abrams and PNAC, that we can use the U.S. military to change any regime we don't like. So while Trump's off meeting with, again, a Marxist-Leninist communist dictator that, you know, fired missiles over Japan, he's going after countries that are absolutely no threat and creating a potential humanitarian crisis on an epic scale in Venezuela.
It's just, it's psychedelic is what it is. So let's talk now, Mark Ash, about the kind of press that Maduro, the leader in Venezuela, has been getting in the American media here. What do we know about him? That he's being portrayed as a terrible dictator, and we keep reading articles about how people hate him. What is the situation actually on the ground in Venezuela in terms of the Maduro administration?
1984? Just goes right back to the Reagan administration. They just opened up the same playbook and went right back to it. Effectively painted the regime, and which is what they do with any regime, what the United States does, and the U.S. press does with any regime, the U.S. State Department, the U.S. CIA decide they're trying to overthrow. Paint the regime as guilty of human rights offenses. Show examples of human rights offenses. Show children suffering, images that will play to the American public, particularly to an American public that does not want to drill down. Once they do that, they create a groundswell of support. And at that point, whatever the U.S. does is justified as saving lives. In fact, it has nothing to do with saving lives. If the United States were not waging aggressive economic warfare against Venezuela and had not been doing so for over two decades, many of the problems that we're seeing in Venezuela simply would not exist. It was the concept of Hugo Chavez, the concept of Maduro after him, has been to use the revenues from the oil to empower the people of Venezuela and enrich the lives of the Venezuelan people, to provide better medicine, to provide better food. And effectively, the United States went to war not only with those governments, but with that concept. The United States press has largely completely ignored that. And they use the same playbook that was being used in the 1980s during the Reagan administration, the Reagan years, and in the Vietnam years, as they did in Libya. It's just, you know, they're bad, we're good, we're going to save them, we need your support to do it, this is where your tax dollars are going to save children, and they refuse to take a look at the broader ramifications of effectively what are wars of profit and colonialism.
Well, they're imperial imposition wars. We're talking about
colonialist wars. Effectively, we want to control their economy and we want to control their resources from afar.
We're talking with Mark Ash, a publisher of Reader Supported News, and Bob Fitricus, publisher of freepress.org. Mark actually mentioned Gaddafi. You actually met Gaddafi. Have you met Maduro?
I haven't met Maduro, but did meet Tito and did meet Gaddafi. I was his honored guest in the front row there, and quite by accident, I was allowed to give the opening remarks on the 40th anniversary of the revolution in the People's Hall in Tripoli. So,
wow.
But again, I blame a lot of that on Cynthia McKinney. I was there as her attorney, And somehow Gaddafi had learned I'd run as the Green Party candidate in Ohio, and his party was the Green Party. Suddenly I'm being escorted into rooms and given speeches saying a very powerful man would greatly be honored. And I didn't get the sense they took no for an answer.
Yeah. Okay. So is Maduro, Bob, in fact, as progressive as Chavez was? Is there a real...
Well, I mean, the big, the rap against Maduro is he's not charismatic. But the thing I found quite odd following the New York Times is they kept referring to Hugo Chavez as, illegitimate dictator. And then as soon as he died, they admitted that he was highly popular and elected. But the new guy just doesn't have the charisma. And again, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation just happened to be down there in the middle of the coup and captured a lot of that. And a lot of this also, of course, is race and caste and color-based with, historically, the descendants of the conquistador and, families with much lighter skin have controlled that Venezuelan oil. And Chavez, was changing it away to benefiting people that were mixed race and indigenous. And, I'm waiting for him to pull out the Noriega 89 and Allende. I'm waiting for the box of red underwear showing that Maduro's a Satan worshiper, with the same guns they pull out all the time, the AKs from Russia. And my favorite is when with Noriega they put a copy of John Toland's biography of Hitler, implying that he was a Nazi instead of that it was a standard scholarly biography, which happened to be in English, and in Noriega wouldn't be reading right. In English. I mean, the stuff is so simple-minded, so brutal, so imperialistic, and it's been pointed out, when's the last time we declare somebody who didn't win an election? This goes back to like de Gaulle and some government in exile. It's really a bizarre situation. I can only think since, we're pulling out of the Middle East and the oil there, and we're, winding down, Syria and Iraq and Afghanistan to some extent is, if you want to please the neocons, nothing they like better than that long history of war in the Western Hemisphere. Going back to this, that famous quote from Smedley Butler, about being a gangster right. For capitalism.
For the boys on Wall Street. Well, of course, if they follow the playbook of getting rid of Noriega, they'll surround Venezuela and play, heavy metal to drive the whole country crazy. Yeah, that's what they did to Noriega.
Right.
And
and to this day, I mean, in Noriega's case, they were serving a warrant on him. I mean, they invaded a country and... essentially kidnapped a sovereign head of state based on a
right.
warrant.
And they killed thousands of people in Panama City.
Oh, yeah, and Chirillo. I mean, the Panama Deception is one of the great documentaries of all time. They burnt down Aunt Chirillo and, just untold casualties and in those dignity brigades in the poor areas of the city.
Outrageous. It's outrageous. Well, do you think, Mark Ash, that we're going to have actual troops going into Venezuela?
Actual troops?
I mean, are we actually going to physically invade
never,
with
something
the
United
Army?
States has never done before. We effectively, what we do have, and there was a great report in Democracy Now! About 10 days ago about assault rifles being spirited into the country on at airports to otherwise cargo shipments, disguised as cargo shipments. So they're actually running guns into Venezuela now. This is probably something that Elliot Abrams is involved in. This is how the United States functions. They empower right-wing, local right-wing death squads, typically. They wouldn't define themselves. But sure, yeah. I mean, it's the same game plan. The guns are going in. The opposition gains strength. The opposition begins to conduct attacks. People begin to die. And it's unfolding. Now, I should note that a lot of things change if someone like Bernie Sanders is elected in 2020. A lot of things change, and that's one of them. That will stop.
That would definitely change. Bernie would. I do not think there's no way Bernie would be doing what Trump is doing. That's no doubt. Now let's talk real quickly about Nicaragua. Aren't they trying to do Bob Fitricus the same thing in Nicaragua that they're doing in Venezuela?
Yeah, and Nicaragua's back on the hit list, and you saw that when Trump mentioned not only Venezuela but threw in Nicaragua. As well as Cuba. And for the record, I did meet the members of the Mano Blanco. I was the international, in charge of the international observers that observed the first ever election after the revolution in El Salvador. And that truth commission was just stunning in terms of the revelation of the types of people. You know, in El Salvador, literally, we were dealing with, you know, nun rapers and, you know, killers of Jesuits, you know, and in Nicaragua, right, the Contras. I mean, the people that brought us the crack epidemic, again, right, the old remnants of Somoza's National Guard. The reports coming out of Nicaragua, equally as bad. But, you know, when we're trying to overthrow these governments, we've never been concerned with good citizenship. We've gotten some of the most brutal people on earth, torturers, drug runners, you know, just thugs.
And I assume that's the people we're going to conjure up in Venezuela. Let's talk about Brazil. You know, this guy in Brazil is a complete Nazi. A psychopath, a criminal. They locked up Lula, who was the rightful upcoming president. And, you know, Brazil is a very, very large country. You know, they're stripping down the Amazon now, assaulting the indigenous. I mean, it's a horrifying situation in Brazil. Mark Ash, have you looked at that at Reader Supported News?
Well, so the conditions you're talking about, stripping down the Amazon, assaulting indigenous rights advocates, indigenous environmental advocates, this has been going on for a long time. It's a very dangerous line of work to be an indigenous rights advocate anywhere in South America, and particularly in Brazil. You can get yourself, it's a great way to get yourself killed quickly. As far as the deforestation of the Amazon, that's been ongoing for quite some time. And I would say that the current leader of Brazil, whose name I struggle to pronounce, I believe it's Bolsonaro.
Something like that.
Help me out here, guys. He seems to see dollar signs or peso signs in them that are trees. And he would like to accelerate the process. His attitude towards the forest is no different than the Trump administration's attitude towards the national monuments here in the United States. Open for sale, right. Open for business. Let's make some money here.
Yeah, the cronies.
And the problem that you have there is that there are always people in Brazil, in the United States, and anywhere else that when you say we can put money into the local economy by cutting, burning, digging, drilling, you name it, regardless of the environmental impact, there are going to be people locally that will say, drill, baby, drill. Cut, baby, cut. And that's how he got elected. People see the potential boost to the Brazilian economy And as far as the environmentalism is concerned, it's perceived to be bad economics. It isn't bad economics, but it's easy to make the argument to people who are A, ignorant, and B, impatient, that it is economically detrimental. And unless you can get those people, before they go to the polls, to lift themselves up from an educational information standpoint, they may very well go in there and vote to let the resources be procured. And
well,
that's
we're looking at an ecological. We're looking at a disaster of global proportions, of course, in Brazil. I assume that Elliot Abrams has gone down to Venezuela to make sure the same thing happens there. We're trying to do it in Nicaragua. Still trying to overthrow the regime and the government in Cuba.
Right, but you got to remember. Harvey. Donald Trump is not Ronald Reagan. The Trump administration is not the Reagan administration. Here's the difference. Donald Trump isn't a true believer. He doesn't believe that he can make the world better through American values in South America. Donald Trump wants to stuff as much money into his pockets as he possibly
right.
can before he jumps into the getaway car. That's
right.
Donald Trump. Okay? It's about him. The people that are orchestrating this nonsense in South America right now are remnants of the Reagan and Bush 1 administrations, and Bush 2, actually. That's their gang. And they have been clamoring to get back in there and clamoring to begin to try to turn the screws in effectively on behalf of their former supporters in those regions. And effectively what Donald Trump is doing is he's saying, yeah, fine, do what you have to do. Don't bother me because I'm busy over here trying to stuff money into my pockets. So there's kind of an uneasy alliance there. These are the same people, and it's deadly serious. But Donald Trump is not, he's not Ronald Reagan. The problem and what you have to be aware of is if this thing begins to start to get ugly, and it can very quickly, Donald Trump is going to jump back from that, and he doesn't want to be involved in that. It's not what he's there for.
Well, what's
he's
the
there
policy
for
difference? What's I mean, you know, the resurrection of Elliot Abrams, a name we haven't heard for years, you know, is a reminder that when you kill a vampire, you're supposed to drive a stake through its heart. But what do you do with people who don't have hearts at all? So what is the real policy difference, Bob Patrick, is tangibly of what's going to happen under Donald Trump into these countries, to Venezuela, Nicaragua, Cuba, Brazil, as opposed to Donald Trump? I mean, what's the real difference going to be in terms of policy?
Well, I've been thinking about that a lot, and I tend to agree with Mark to the extent that Donald Trump isn't being led by the ideology. I mean, the neoconservatives, there's a reason why you call these people neocons, because they used to be, you know, leftists. You know, they came out of... you know, many of them were followers of Max Shackman or linear descent of, you know, a offshoot of Trotskyism, including, you know, Irving Kristol wrote Two Cheers from Capitalism. You know, somewhere at the end of the Vietnam War, they came to the conclusion that you needed U.S. military to destroy this new class bureaucracy that wasn't a degenerate worker state. And a lot of these people were really around Gene Kirkpatrick, you know, at the former UN ambassador, and they're absolutely, you know, ideologues. And that, you know, Bolton's in that category, Elliot Abrams, and again, the people that, you know, brought us the attack on Iraq as well. I mean, again, you know, they had a hit list. And it looks like in the Western Hemisphere, it's Venezuela, Cuba and Nicaragua. It's a replay. But I think Donald Trump made some necessary moves. I mean, the bubble burst on the neocons, right? Neoliberal free trade and this aggressive foreign policy with Hillary Clinton. But, you know, those forces still have tremendous power. You know, the group that was around PNAC, the Project for a New American Century, and they had ties to people like Cheney and of course, Bolton. So I think in order to placate, you know, those people, that Trump, who's not an ideologue and not a neocon, you know, kind of, you know, looks like they get to have Venezuela and you know, intervene in Nicaragua again and harass Cuba for no reasonable reason in the world. So I think Mark's right there. Is that what, you know, when you're bringing back the true believers, you're bringing back the people that said in 1990 with the collapse of the Soviet Union, we have 20 to 25 years to remake the world using the U.S. military and get rid of any, you know, socialist dictator that we don't want. It's still their dream.
What's that, Mark?
Like Bernie Sanders?
Yeah. Well, let's see what happens here. I mean, you know, it's one thing. You look at the let's switch now over. I want to start talking a bit about Michael Cohen's presentation yesterday and what it means. As usual, most of the Democrats were utterly worthless, just grandstanding and airheaded. I mean, the Republicans were, oh, my God. I mean, where do you get these clowns? And, of course, you know.
Well, you know, Jim Jordan's from Ohio, and he was assistant coach during a huge sex scandal where the team doctor was assaulting the players on the team. So that's, you know, that's an interesting
and he didn't
one.
Say a word, of course. Yeah, and, you know, he's Jim, that guy, I think he did too much wrestling without a helmet. But, you know. The one thing that I thought the only really important thing, well, Alexandria Cortez did come up with the one lead-in to more prosecution. And I think she, unlike so many other Democrats, realized that the only really important thing is how did Trump break the law and will he be prosecuted for it? Now, there was one section where Michael Cohen outlined a clear felony that was perpetrated by the Trumps, where Michael Cohen, apparently put up his personal money to pay off Stormy Daniels, and who Bob and I went to see perform in Columbus. To pay Michael Cohen back, Trump funneled the money and asked Michael Cohen to bill him as if he were being paid for services performed, when in fact he was just being paid back the money he put out. Now, that's a felony. And there was one Democrat congressman who made that clear. And he had his priorities.
Well, specifically, what it means is that is the crime for which Michael Cohen is going to federal prison for election.
Exactly.
For campaign finance fraud. But we're forgetting that the candidate was Donald Trump, and it was his girlfriend that was involved. Now, why is Donald Trump still parading around the Oval Office like a peacock?
Because the Democrats have no spine, and they also don't control the Senate. But, you know, and Nancy Pelosi has allegedly taken impeachment off the table. But what we get now, the other thing is that the two magic words that Steve Bannon has said will bring Trump down, I don't think were spoken all day, and those two words are money laundering. And, you know, for some reason, these guys, these Congress people, the Democrats, do not want to get in to the 30-year history of Donald Trump laundering money for Russian oligarchs.
It did come up briefly, Harvey, and the explanation, you had Cohen talking about, I didn't see satchels of rubles, but I mean, that's absurd. That's not how you launder money. You launder money by sending, you know, Russian mafia money or Putin money, you know, to Baku, Azerbaijan, in a, you know, $1 billion Trump project that's never opened and never made sense in the first place. You launder the money through, you know, through the casinos and through his luxury buildings. It's the perfect place. And if you read, you know, investment, you know, Business Insider, Daily Investment News, The New Yorker, you know, this the stuff on, you know, Trump, by virtually all the major business magazines, and they all point to money laundering.
Well, but it's not just mobsters that are laundering money. Both Deutsche Bank and HSBC have both been sanctioned for support for sustaining money laundering systems. Effectively, they'll take money as deposit from anyone and allow them to legitimize it by putting it into a bank account. It doesn't matter whether the money's gleaned through prostitution, drug running, gun running. They don't care. This is
right.
Deutsche Bank.
And
this is HSBC. These are two organizations that do a lot of business here in the United States as legitimate banking organizations. And we're deeply involved, by the way, in the housing debacle in 2007, 2008, and 2009.
Yes.
No, I actually bought the house I'm in that collapsed in that period. So where I'm standing was bought from the Deutsche Bank.
Right. And they were heavily involved. I mean, heavily involved. These are, we think of money launderers as shaky guys in suits that don't fit well. That's not at all what we're talking about. This guy, Alex Vanderswan, who actually did 30 days in jail having been convicted by Robert Mueller. I mean, at the end of the day, this guy was an attorney for money launderers. That's what he does. He's their front guy. This is who we're talking about. And this is what Donald Trump, I mean, this property that he had in Florida, I mean, the property was valued at $45 million. He sells it to a Russian oligarch for $91 million. What happened to the other $46 million bucks?
Right. So the question now is, Michael Cohen has been testifying behind closed doors again today. The question is, are they getting into any of this stuff?
Behind closed doors, they can get into a lot of different things. But what I really think happened, I wrote an article on this today titled, I Love to Watch Republicans Suffer. Effectively, what he probably did is he knew in advance by having – through his communications with the prosecutors from Southern District of New York, he knew what pieces of evidence would play in that hearing yesterday. He knew what he could present that would, A, make an impact, and, B, be verifiable. He wasn't just in there shooting shit. He wasn't just talking out of his tailpipe. He knew what he was saying. He knew perfectly well what the evidence showed because he's been involved in collecting that evidence and pointing the prosecutors in Southern District of New York to that evidence. So he knows where the evidence is. And he knows he knows perfectly well as a lawyer that if he says it in front of that committee, not only does it need to be true, it needs to be verifiable because then it'll have an impact. And he knows that. So the issues that he touched on are probably issues that he knows are verifiable.
Right. But the question then is, what did he say yesterday that will lead to indictments? Now,
He presented the check. The check is verified by the audio conversation he has on the telephone and by Alan Weisselberg, who was the accountant. There were several. His account of the dealings with David Pecker at AMI, those things are all verifiable by several parties that were in the room. That's all campaign finance. Those are all the crimes for which he is now being sentenced to prison. The elephant on the coffee table is that he's the only one being sentenced so far. The candidate, the guy that was actually sleeping with the porn star, he's not going to jail yet.
Let's give Stormy Daniels the benefit of the break here. They never slept together, and they apparently were about their sex act took under a minute. I really wanted it, you know.
And as you've pointed out, Harvey, she did describe the first member.
Yeah, the first member as a toadstool. The most damning thing I ever heard said about John Kennedy was that Marilyn Monroe implied he wasn't very good in bed. And boy, Stormy really nailed Trump on that one. Well, Bob, isn't the key next person we're going to hear from Weiselberg? I mean, are we going to see him next, or is he going to wind up one day in the bottom of the Hudson with cement shoes?
Weiselberg has already testified in great detail to Mueller's investigators. They've got him coming. They've got him going. The big difference between Donald Trump and his Russian friends is Donald Trump doesn't know what to do when his rats flip. The Russians kill you, and they kill a lot of people. This is why Paul Manafort chose jail over Mueller. Now, if I'm 72 years old, why do I choose going to jail over talking to Bob Mueller? Because I'm more afraid of Oleg Deripaska, who was his handler, his Russian oligarch and handler. This guy will be.
If anybody would know the deep details of the money laundering, it would be Weiselberg, not Michael Cohen.
Well, it would be also Manafort. That was his. Manafort was a career money launderer. That was his whole thing in life. He's like Weiselberg knows where the money went, but Weiselberg couldn't have operated as a legitimate business person, which he did, if he was a money launderer. Manafort was an international money launderer. That was his shtick. That was his gig, and had been from day one. He knew exactly what he was doing. But the reason he's not talking is because he's afraid.
Well, they'll kill him one way or another.
Manafort was also in obviously on the election rehabilitation of the pro-Russian candidate, and he also worked, as I've told Harvey before, with Michael O'Connell, you know, the IT guy who created the back door in the Ohio system in 2004. That later was verified in the King Lincoln case before his untimely death. I mean, so, these people, I mean, they got all the skills. They have the money laundering. They have the, and a lot of these people were operating in Ohio, particularly Connell, in 2004. In fact, when we wrote the book, Harvey, on what happened in Ohio, one of the things was the vanishing in Cleveland of all the mail-in ballots that were picked up by freshly scrubbed individuals in suits and never made it down to the Board of Election.
Right, and we finally saw an indictment on something like that in North Carolina. I mean, that's pretty much what happened in that congressional district in North Carolina.
Yeah, the first do-over in 40 years for a congressional election.
Well,
yeah, it's pretty amazing.
But it's not the first time that they did what they did to cause the do-over. That's just basically a standard Southern swamp run election. We're surprised because we're looking at it on national television now, but the people that live there have been seeing that now since Jim Crow and before.
Well, we saw it in Ohio 2004.
Well, this is actually a little bit worse. I mean, going out and actually picking up the ballots and filling them in and throwing them in the trash and all the rest of this nonsense. I mean, that's...
They did that in Cleveland. I mean, they had some areas where the vote totals were like 9%, made no sense. Yeah, and they used the old one, too, where a right-wing constitutional law fascist party ended up getting 60, 70, 80% of the vote in the key African American districts. I mean, they used a variety of tactics that I have no doubt probably were quite common in the South, but they were kind of new wrinkles in Ohio.
Yeah, so we're talking with Mark Ashley, publisher of Reader Supported News, and Bob Fakirkas, the publisher of freepress.org. We're unfortunately getting down to the wire here. So the question is, what happens next? I mean, I think they're going to probably try to make Weiselberg testify in public. That'll be interesting. But, you know, I got to hand it to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I mean, she really beamed down on what's important. I hope that some of the other Democrats next time around will do it. I do think that, you know, the key of what Michael Cohen said yesterday was he did present a verifiable felony. I'm surprised that was the only one.
Oh my God,
we're almost done.
Campaign
finance. Hey, you guys, you've been great.
And remember again, the accusation came out that Trump knew about WikiLeaks before they were leaked.
Yeah, boy, that's not going to do Julian Assange any good. Mark Ash, you want to take
an important point? And yes, that was verifiable too. Yes.
All right,
there were multiple parties.
We'll have you back.
All right, thanks, Harvey.
So we had to pay the cost,
and so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things.